Don Rutherford is in the Department of Philosophy at UCSD, specializes in the history of modern philosophy, written a lot about Leibniz, has a wonderful Cambridge companion to early modern philosophy, and his current book is The Wisdom of the Moderns, Science of Happiness in 17th Century Philosophy.
Good. Book in progress, not finished.
Book in progress.
Yes. So as I heard the previous talks, I began to think, God, I wish I'd read these talks or heard the talks beforehand so I could completely rewrite my paper. But in the last couple of minutes, I thought, yeah, I do have something to say about the issues that have already been on the table. And this short paper, I'm going to be primarily addressing two points, or making two points. One is that the questions that we've been dealing with and the very idea of enlightenment, or at least the manifestations of enlightenment, have been with us for a long, long time. And I want to interject the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, into the discussion, because I think in some sense we're inventing the wheel, or human beings have, over the course of our intellectual history, been reinventing the wheel many times. That's part of what we do in thinking about these things. And I've really been led to this, you know, from the point of view of the 17th century and thinking about, you know, the pre-Enlightenment views of people like Spinoza and Hobbes, and then thinking, you know, well, you know, how are they breaking with the what's going on in their particular intellectual milieu? And in many cases, it's that they are picking up ideas from the ancient Epicureans or ancient Stoics and putting them to some new use, and that is liberating for them, right? And so if that's liberating for them, where's the source of the liberation? It's in the ancients. That's one thing I want to put on the table. The other thing I want to put on the table is that in thinking about these questions, you know, what draws people to religion, what makes them believe in gods, the first thing that strikes me here is that this is very much a first-person issue. This is people confronting basic facts about their life, their mortality, the kinds of suffering they may be dealing with. And there's a question here that people have to answer for themselves about the value of their own existence, what they're looking for to give their life value. And again, it seems to me that this first-person perspective is one, this perspective of practical reason, is one that we find in the ancients raised perhaps more directly there than in some modern treatments of the issue. So that's something I'm going to bring in to the discussion also. So the question that concerns me here is our understanding of the end and value of human life, especially the human life that is mine. On the basis of what do I find or fail to find my life to be a thing of value that I am motivated to pursue with energy and commitment? Where, in other words, do I locate my happiness? Now, this is a question I think that human beings have posed to themselves for as long as we have a written record. And they have posed it in much the same way as we pose it to ourselves today, the way that everyone poses it to themselves. And I think on the basis of their answers, we can distinguish people into two very broad classes, people who I will call this-worlders and people who I'll call other-worlders. This-worlders are content to say that human life is pursued for its own sake, that it contains ample opportunities for enrichment and enjoyment that make it worth living. Moreover, they add, if a life doesn't have these features, there is little that can be done about it. That is the basis of what we call tragedy. And you accept that. Otherworlders take the opposite tack. They begin from the assumption that this life cannot sustain an understanding of human happiness. Beyond this life, there must be something else in virtue of which we may regard ourselves as happy, if not now, then at some point in the future. Now, it seems to me this distinction is robust, this holds, so I want to say a little bit more about it. Otherworlders have dominated Western culture. At every point, they have found something frightening, unsatisfying, or incomplete about this life, and they have turned to the idea of another world in which they have sought solace, satisfaction, and completeness. They have done this with more or less intellectual sophistication. They have prayed to invisible powers and absent parents to render them safe or to ease their burden. More abstractly, they have reasoned that the values and explanatory schemes of human life cannot stand on their own as expressions of our way of doing things, but require a ground in another kind of reality, one free of the contingency, vulnerability, and brute arbitrariness that attends human existence. And that's just the point I think we're just talking about, whether that ground is necessary and where it might be. Otherworlders, I emphasize, can be uneducated followers of cults or philosophers who reason their way to the necessary existence of God or the form of the good. Plato, obviously, is an otherworlder, as are Descartes, Leibniz, and Kant. Each of these philosophers insists that in terms of its existence, the foundations of morality, and the unanswered hopes of human beings, the world cannot stand on its own. We need more, logically, morally, psychically, and so more must exist. There must be somewhere else, some other kind of reality, some other world that we can appeal to as the foundation of our fundamental hopes, beliefs, values. This-worlders reject the inference to a beyond. For them, life is valued for its own sake and for what can be made of it. A human life can be more or less satisfying to its subject. Within limits, we can employ our intelligence to improve our condition. Nevertheless, there are limits of time, space, and power that are inherent in a human life, and a mature human being recognizes and accepts these limits, acknowledging that nothing outside of this world can sustain or redeem that which we cannot sustain or redeem ourselves. Within the ancient world, the party of this-worlders is represented most faithfully by the followers of Epicurus. Now, I should say here, there's another side to this question also. We brought up values of equality and cosmopolitanism and those we find in the ancient Stoics. But if we're looking for a this-worldly philosophy, we can't find a better example than Epicureanism. Epicureans begin from the premise that nature consists solely of material atoms moving in a void. Chance encounters of these atoms result in larger material structures, plants, animals, human beings, and ultimately worlds, or galaxies, or solar systems. No providential plan governs the coming into being or passing away of anything, including human beings. Epicureans profess ignorance about the existence of gods, but they assert that if gods were to exist, they would have nothing to do with us. Wouldn't bother about us. Why would they? They're gods. They have a blessed life. Thus, we are on our own in the universe, and what we make of our life is up to us. The aim of Epicurean ethics is to offer specific advice on this point, making what we make of our life. Like almost all the ancient schools, Epicureans approach ethics from the point of view of happiness, which they conceive as a final end of action. In deliberating about how to live, we act with the aim of enjoying a happy life, insofar as we are rational. Obviously, there are huge differences in how people conceive of such a life. The ancients were preoccupied with debating the adequacy of different conceptions of happiness as competing answers to our most basic practical concern. And those debates can go on within the context of this world. For Epicureans, a happy life has two essential features. It's a life free of physical pain and of mental disturbance. Epicureans argue that pain is the one thing that any human being seeks to avoid in his or her life. A happy life, therefore, is first and foremost a life free of pain. Contrary to popular myth, the Epicureans are not unbridled pleasure seekers. Such a life, they believe, will inevitably lead to great pain. The most pleasant or happy life is one in which we're able to satisfy our desires, whatever they may be, without unnecessary friction. The Epicureans offer practical advice on how this can be achieved. Most importantly, they recommend that we choose wisely the desires we seek to satisfy and that we free ourselves from fear of the gods and anxiety about death. On the last point, they famously argue that we have no reason to fear death because death is nothing to us. So I've highlighted the example of Epicureanism because it demonstrates the existence, by the end of the 4th century BCE, of a sophisticated this-worldly philosophy which rests on a non-providential view of nature and is responsive to precisely the sorts of worries about the judgments of gods and the terrors of death that lead people toward religion. It's there already. Of course, even this-worlders may balk at the details of Epicurean ethics. Many in the ancient world felt it gave short shrift to virtue or to moral right. And so a this-worldly ethic might be better cast in the form of Aristotle's theory, for example, which conceives of human happiness as a form of practical rational activity which is pleasing to us given our biological nature. But at this point, I suggest, we've moved to the level of evaluating rival this-worldly theories in the interest of establishing which of them conforms best to our preconceptions about and aspirations for human life, and that debate can go on within, against the background of, an assumption that this world is what we've got to work with. Now, on the basis of these considerations, and particularly the example of Epicureanism, I want to put three propositions on the table for future discussion. First, the struggle which we are addressing here, the struggle between those who feel compelled to believe and the 7% of us who don't, it's been going on for a long time and shows few signs of abating, in my view. That's what Newsweek magazine tells us. It behooves us, I think, to keep this fact squarely in front of us. The temptations of belief have long been recognized by this-worldly philosophers who have offered diagnoses of the underlying errors and advanced conceptions of happiness that avoid those errors. The Epicureans themselves were pessimistic as to whether their enlightened view of human existence would ever be acceptable to more than a small elite. The majority of people, they opined, would cling stubbornly to their gods. The subsequent spread of the two dominant monotheistic religions, Christianity and Islam, bears this point out, I believe. Second, the dramatic development of the methods and theories of the natural sciences since the 17th century have done little to move us beyond the problem space of Epicureanism. In many ways, we are still in the process of moving back to their perspective, having taken a 2,000-year detour through the book of Genesis. Our conception of nature is the Epicurean conception with a few more details. And so far as I can see, these details by themselves do not support a stronger case against religion than the Epicureans themselves were able to offer. If you were going to be convinced, you would have probably been convinced by them. The movement back to the Epicurean position began in the 17th century in the work of philosophers such as Gassendi, Hobbes, Locke, and Spinoza. In its early phase, it was largely subordinated to the sideshow of reconciling Epicurean physics, i.e. atomism, and ethics, i.e. hedonism, with Christianity. That is, at that point, they were trying to revive those principal doctrines, but then put them together with Christianity. And so, in some sense, they weren't getting the point of the Epicurean position. Only later, with Hume in particular, from within the philosophical canon, did we get to the main event, which returned to the foreground the issue of whether human life can be seen as sufficient unto itself, metaphysically and ethically. As I intimated at the outset, the crucial factor in determining whether one is drawn toward or away from this world is not just what one knows about the world, but how one reconciles oneself to that knowledge. One can comprehend the full informational content of modern science and still be pulled toward another world if out of fear or dissatisfaction one fails to find the makings of happiness in this life. And there are well-known examples of such people. Third, I submit that the example of the ancients remains instructive to us as we undertake the work of formulating a cogent account of our ethical and moral commitments. The breakthroughs of modern science in evolutionary theory, genomics, and neuroscience will continue to add important facts to our knowledge of ourselves, facts that delineate the range of our responsiveness to the world. But they will not by themselves determine a conception of the value of human life, the sources of its enrichment, and the possibilities of its embellishment. At the end of the day, the interesting questions, from my point of view, is not just what we are, the factual question, or how the mind works, what modules it has, but the account we can give ourselves of our own happiness and flourishing within the acknowledged limits of a human life. And here, I believe, art, literature, and philosophy has as much to offer us as the natural sciences do. Thank you.
So we'll take a couple of quick questions, then I think we need to go to a break. David Brin at the back there, Michael, and Rex Kerr behind him.
Yes, I wouldn't put too much stock in these 7% solutions. The polls often add very leading questions, and that does not mean that 93% of the people do not feel a commitment to most of the Enlightenment values that we're discussing here. What it testifies to is the complexity of human nature. And the same is true when you make a distinction between otherworldliness and thisworldliness. For instance, I am here wearing the hat of a person who's trained in the sciences and is committed to the Enlightenment and therefore this worldliness, yet I make my living creating other worlds. It has to do with the seriousness with which you invest your indignation, your indignant fury upon the defense of a particular model. And that is what the Enlightenment works against. The imagination is otherworldliness. And the Enlightenment uses as a grist, as fertilizer, as air, the other world of the imagination. So this is a dichotomy that I do have a little trouble with. I think the distinction is not between this and other worlds. It's more to do with whether or not we believe in our own accountability and our ability to be flexible about these worlds.
Actually, that very term, saeva indignatio, is Swiftian, isn't it? That's Jonathan Swift, so it was another science fiction writer. Scott Atran, yes.
Yeah,
Hey.
So, Mr. Slingerland's talk, which I thought was very good. The responses I heard to that were that these metaphysical postulates conform to evolution or can be made to conform with spectacles. They win out in history over competitors like tyranny, with or without spectacles, and therefore you don't need any metaphysical postulates. So far, that's what I got the argument to be. First, as a matter of fact, human life has been short, nasty, and brutal for almost all of its existence and in almost all cultures. When out, it's not clear at all that human rights, individual rights, respect, and tolerance are winning out even in this century, certainly not in the last century, and where it has won out, it's been extremely intermittent and only in Western Europe for a period of less than 50 years. Sacred values are not defined by the fact that they make us uncomfortable. Sacred values are empirically defined by the fact that they are independent, they are realized independently or all out of proportion for prospects of success. And if you do experiments on sacred values, on values you hold to be sacred, whether they're religious or human rights, you find that the more you give a material explanation and incentive for them, the more outraged and disgusted people become about them. So it is not a material incentive that makes you believe in such values. And finally, that Tom will go away. Well, Tom is a scientific postulate like electrons or ether, and it may go away if proven to be false or inadequate, but it's certainly not that kind of metaphysical postulate.
Tom meaning theory of mind, of course. Dan, did you want to say something about that?
No, I'll say it.
Oh, you say it in your talk. Okay. Dan, do you want to have a word? Okay. Daniel Smale.
Thanks. I've been fascinated by this discussion from a historian's point of view, in particular about what it has done, in a sense, to history, at least large stretches of what we call human history. I was reminded of, some of you will remember, in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, at the very beginning when the Brave New World is set up, Mustafa Mond declares the end of history, and he does it by destroying museums and libraries because we don't need any history anymore. And in a very similar way, there's a lot of very similar currents going on in this room. I was thinking of Paul and Dan's comments about the series of human experiments, perhaps getting at Enlightenment 2.0 and finally getting it right, which I think was also embedded in Ted's remarks as well. And I think this is part of what Scott is replying to, namely that there may be an imagined natural morality back there, but is it actually a deeply natural moral world, a sort of the hunter-gatherer society that we're thinking of in some historical sense way back there? What I find really interesting is that if one posits a natural morality that produces, through evolutionary processes, a moral capacity embedded in the brain that is not necessarily religious capacity, then the human history from the agricultural revolution down to the industrial revolution becomes what Robert Sapolsky calls one of the greatest stupid mistakes of all time. And in a sense, then the historians who study it are just a little bit kooky. I was chatting with Stuart last night, and Stuart very comfortingly said to me, I'm not one of those who thinks that history, like most scientists, who thinks that history is a pile of shit, which really sort of struck home the point about, you know, what are the historians doing meddling about in this sort of odd era. So it does make me wonder whether this symposium is about Enlightenment 2.0 or about Utopia 2.0.
I'd like to raise the idea that maybe Enlightenment 2.0 just hasn't gone far enough yet, and that some of these questions that we have about, for example, whether we can give an account of our own happiness is not something that is unaddressable by methods of reason and science and introspection. It's just that we have not yet progressed far enough in our understanding of biology and the human brain and so forth so that we can give the kind of satisfying, comprehensive account that we would like to have. So I think that I'd like to suggest that maybe the jury is still out there, or maybe we even have indications that that we don't need these metaphysical entities, that they will get pushed back also with increasing understanding.
Sam, do you want to say anything on that?
Yeah, I think I'll address some of this in my talk, but I just want to point out that the only thing you need to be a moral realist without having to appeal to transcendental values and other postulates is to, one, believe that morality is about questions of suffering and happiness and the difference there in conscious systems, not just humans. And two, to believe that there are right and wrong answers to those questions. I mean, is everything up for grabs, or are there better or worse strategies to produce human happiness? And the moment you acknowledge better and worse there, you can be a realist, and you can admit that these questions are open to the kind of refined empirical studies that we have yet to do, frankly, but that there's no reason to imagine that there aren't facts to be found there.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Greg Epstein. I wouldn't have predicted that Sam would take the words out of my mouth, but I mean, I think that the question of suffering and happiness is really important, because I think that it's the sort of simple beginning that we, I would say, humanists, non-theists, whatever you want to call us, that we are coming from this question that our ethics start with a pretty simple proposition that we are against human suffering and we're for human happiness in exactly the Epicurean sense. And a couple things that I think to me flow from that that are important. One, I mean, I really enjoyed Margaret's talk about the Enlightenment, but I wanted to say about this comment that is what distinguishes us that we have no ritual? I mean, is no ritual a guarantor of lack of suffering and and happiness? I mean, I think that would really impoverish us. We can't have weddings and funerals, that sort of thing. I would say that what really distinguishes us is that we start with that premise of human happiness. And it's the difference between starting from the premise of what God wants. In either case, there's a lot of work to be done from there, but I think that we're going to get to better conclusions if we start from the premise of trying to work towards human happiness.
So as humanist chaplain at Harvard, right, you espouse rituals.
Well, I think that if rituals lead to human happiness, we should do them. You know, there's a lot of work to be done in figuring out which rituals do and which rituals don't. But to simply say, well, we're Enlightenment people, so we don't do ritual. I mean, I think that that's a mistake that's impoverishing.
There's a mic up there with Beatrice. Do you have it?
Yes. I think the sort of more consistent observation historically and cross-culturally is that people are interested not in human happiness and minimization of human suffering, but in maximization of their happiness and minimization of their suffering. And from culture to culture, you see that although we may think our values are innate and intrinsically driven because they're so strongly culturally entrenched, from culture to culture in this century and from time to time within our culture, those values have differed. The values regarding the sanctity of life and the sanctity of childhood. It might seem pleasant to say that our values drive a pragmatic view, but it depends on what the outcome is that pragmatism is being addressed against. Would childhood slavery better, for example, lead to the outcome of pyramids that last for centuries and centuries? Pragmatism depends on which outcomes it is that you're examining, and I think we can't make the presumption that our values are innate. And I think the points that were made by the earlier speaker must be borne in mind, that we have values, but let's accept that and say, how can we use information, evidence, inference drawn from evidence to maximize outcomes in the face of the values that we do have?
Okay. One last comment before we go to a break. Deirdre, do you want to say something?
I think it's I have a speech defect, so it's not that easy. My name is Deirdre McCluskey. I'm an economist who drifted. I think it's unlikely on its face that science is going to teach us how to be flourishing human beings. I think pain and suffering in utilitarian terms is exactly not the correct place to start ethical considerations. After all, it's the point of religion and tragedy and art that life is hard, and for it to have some point, it has to have a point beyond just of avoiding pain. Human life, we're meaning-seeking animals. I don't think we can get away from that. We're not cats. Cats avoid pain and sit on the sill in the sunlight and enjoy themselves. As a famous Anglican theologian said, man doth seek a triple perfection. And it's that third thing that science can't provide us.
Dan, yeah, final comment, yeah, and then we'll go.
This is on. I just want to weigh in quickly on happiness and ritual. I wrote a book on the history of happiness, and right in the middle of it I have a vignette on what goes on in France at the height of the Jacobin Terror, a time when Saint-Just has famously stood up in the French Revolution and declared happiness a new idea in Europe, happiness of this world as opposed to the false happiness of the next. A time when the Jacobin Constitution of the year 3 has declared the goal of society is common happiness. And they're struggling, you know, how to ritualize this, and well, what do? The Jacobins send representatives on mission out throughout the country to preach sermons on happiness in former Catholic churches, now dubbed temples of reason. You know, this is what you get. I write about them at great length. At the very time, of course, that the guillotine's falling, and I think I want to just go back to Edward's point, that this does illustrate the fact that whether or not one thinks that you have to, you know, Charles Taylor, think of the Enlightenment as a religion, make an ontological move to think that, you know, all our values are invested with some sort of metaphysical significance. I think on a historical level, as this gentleman was pointing out, clearly people do this. And, you know, one of the points of my happiness book is that happiness has become a kind of modern sacred value, invested with all kinds of meaning. And one sees this, I think, in some of the recent happiness literature. It is the end and be all of life, the telos of life. That has quasi-religious dimensions, and that's not to say that we can't think more seriously about a science of happiness, but on a historical level, clearly human beings have invested all kinds of secular values with sacred meaning that's given them charge and power, often dangerously so, as I would argue the case of the Jacobins illustrates, or the better example clearly is Marxism, which becomes a kind of secular religion in the 19th century, and as we all know, results in terrible chaos and suffering.